taking it back.
All right, Uhuru. This is your host, Iyapo Angina, filling in for Matthew with White Solidarity with Black Power. This show is being hosted. Actually, we're going to be praying a program this evening. It was the main presentation made by the chairman, Amalia Shatella. The African People Solidarity Committee is currently engaged in their three-day conference around building solidarity with the African world for liberation and self-determination. And this conference for APSC is happening all weekend through Monday. So we're going to be playing the main presentation by Amalia Shatella today on the show. We hope you enjoy, and we'll see you again next week. You're logged in to uhururadio.com, a project of the African People's Socialist Party.
Well, thank you so much. And I want to join Comrade Finney in welcoming everybody here to St. Petersburg and saluting the comrades here in St. Petersburg who worked so hard to make this conference happen. I also want to appreciate the fact that Penny has seen at least 30 more years. And that's important, you see, because one of the things that makes Penny very important and is responsible for most of you being here is the fact that she can see the future. And that's the thing that distinguishes us as revolutionaries, as scientists. Not that we are fortune tellers, but because someone once said, I think it was Engels, and it's true, is that freedom is the recognition of necessity. And we understand some things about laws of social development, and that is recognition of necessity. And so Penny has been able to see the future. That's the thing that makes it possible for us to be here when everything to the rest of the world seems so bad and people are bogged down in despair and what have you. We can see the future. In some ways, it's like having the flu, you know? And it's that way you actually feel like you're going to die. But if you know anything about it, you know, 7 days, this is going to be over, you know? And to be able to see the future is really important. That's why we're having this and other kinds of discussions. I want to acknowledge, of course, someone who everybody here is probably familiar with, Comrade Gaida, who is sits on the political bureau of the party and who is a dynamic driving force for virtually every bit of work that we see happening out there in the world. And I wanted to acknowledge her. And most of you probably know by now Comrade Sister Aisha, who is the leader of the incredible African People's Development, All African People's Development project that we have initiated. She is going to head that work up. She is heading that work up. And somebody we are extraordinarily proud to have in our ranks. Some of you know my wife, Ona. But more important than that, she is a comrade who's becoming increasingly important to this work. She has assumed the responsibility of initiating what will probably be one of the major fundraisers for Uhuru Radio. We won't be able to kick that off until next year. The main project that, which will probably be an annual project, we're still working on tweaking some of that, and who has already agreed to lead a lot of the fundraising for the ASI work that we're involved in. And who I think is in the process of assuming the responsibility of organizing at least the St. Petersburg area of the tour, of my tour. So And I think, as delightful as it may be in terms of her being my wife, I think the most important thing is that she's joined the work to advance the struggle of our folk. I said delightful as it may be, but that's a one-sided statement. I would also like to recognize the significance of APSC. And I would imagine some of this, you know, will be said over the next 2 days as well. But it cannot be understated. I mean, this whole issue of being able to see the future, being able to grapple with theory, which is so important. We're going to talk a little bit about that. And also to be around comrades with whom you've had an opportunity to work for so many years. You begin to know each other in different ways, and the camaraderie is something that someone who has never experienced it cannot understand. And that's despite the fact that we recognize the contradictions in the room, in all of us. We have all kinds of struggles. I was listening to Penny acknowledging Comrade Sandy. It was sort of like Back to the Future. I bore you, and certainly bore and perhaps embarrassed Sandy to some extent, remembering how I met her in Oakland, California. When she was a less than loyal employee, worker for KPFA radio station, and she came to cover the fact we had seized this house, initiating a magnificent land reform campaign in Oakland. And we had seized this house that was owned by the city and had called on people to come and work on the house because we were going to put this African woman and her family in the house who had no place to live. And people responded magnificently, and we had repaired the house and was doing incredible work, and Sandy was covering this for KPFA. And people moved, and we learned that the city anticipated the city moving on the house, so we moved the woman in, and Sandy spent the night in the house. And the police raided the joint. And Sandy went to jail. I said, damn, we've lost this comrade, right? And Sandy said, that's what won her. I know the struggles with Sandy. I mean, I know the contradictions with Sandy. And they're interesting contradictions. In fact, in some ways, this edge that she brings with her is part of the ring thing that makes her so valuable. She's just got to contain it inside our organization. She's got to have it in this organization. And I know, you know, so many other comrades. I always mistakenly refer to Ali as somebody who I met in Atlanta, which is not true. I've come to, I don't know why I wanted to place you in Atlanta.
I was in that house with Sandy.
You were in the house with Sandy. Well, we've got a wonderful picture of Ruby when we, and during the same campaign, during the same general campaign, when we established a tent city. These guys, the refuge think they've got a tent city here. Yeah, you know, we established a tent city, took over this park. And decided we were going to set up tents and had people bring in equipment, etc. And the police department came in virtually every vehicle they had available. They came on horses, they came on motorcycles, cars, helicopters, and what have you, and attacked the place. The moment we dragged off one piece of lumber to erect the tents, and I remember this picture of Ruby flat on her stomach with a pig, a cop, a policeman, an officer of the law, with his knee in her back, you know? And I mean, just, you know, comrades, when you go through certain kinds of things with comrades, you know where they're gonna be. You know, and that's why this notion that you can build a revolutionary organization in the classroom, is so fallacious because the test, you know where people are going to be because you've seen them tested. And over many, many years, over all kinds of incredible struggles, you know. If Susan Worth could have survived, she'd been a good comrade, wouldn't she?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this is a comrade whose mother had her kidnapped, you know, by some anti-cult people to deprogram her, right? And to remember her being dragged down the steps of the city hall where you can, the videotape where you can hear every bump on the steps and her voice says she was screaming, right? you know, but just incredible comrades. Kitty, who did a front kick that upended somebody from the Spartans' league, and blooded them, and they had this terrible picture in the Spartans newspaper of this very blooded person who had been victimized by the racist gurus, and we kicked him just because we knew he was in a relationship with an African woman. That's why we kicked him. And but Kitty didn't even remember kicking him. You know, so I don't know if that's a good defense or not. But you know, you get to know comrades, and it's really important. And the tedious, mundane, grinding kind of work that you do for years and years and years, that also is telling. And so I just want to say how much I appreciate this. And APSC was founded in this city in 1976. I think it was September and October of that year. It was the last of September and early October of 1976. We had the conference here. Had a lot of people at that conference, by the way. Had a lot of people at that conference from everywhere. You know, from Kentucky and Alabama, from New York, from Maine, you know, from all over. And they were with us for the duration of the conference and for about a week afterwards. And then, of course, even subsequent to then, had a lot of folk, didn't we? Had a lot of folk in different places, but the whole process of building up a revolutionary cadre and someone who could see a future, not the pity charity politic that so many white people are willing to participate in because it can feel good. I mean, I feel good every time I do some pity charity stuff, but somebody who is participating in changing the world. And that's what it's about. And that's the one thing I would just like to say is that when we talk about doing this work and we talk about the African Revolution, where we come from as African internationalists is recognizing, and every one of us who's heard this theory, this politic, recognizing we are talking about more than Africa. That our theory explains the world to us. That's the thing that's so significant to us. You can't, how in the hell can you understand the question of Africa and black people in isolation from the rest of the world? Well, you can't do that. And so that's the thing that makes it really important to participate in this work. It's not the quote-unquote free African people as such, but it's a part of the process of emancipation of humanity, including yourselves. And what we have come to understand is that there are trillion contradictions that exist in the world, in human society. But the thing is, you cannot work on all these contradictions all the time, but even recognizing contradictions, it is important for us to know that there's a main primary contradiction around which all the others revolve. A primary contradiction. And what we've come to understand is that this fundamental contradiction that we're talking about is this, it revolves around this question of what we refer to as primitive accumulation. The whole world is as it is. The whole world, all of our relationships in the world are as they are because of this thing that we call primitive accumulation. That is a consequence of how Europe moved at a certain time in history, and everybody has been grappling with the implications, the impact, the consequences of that. And so when we deal with this question, it's like, isn't it, what is the mythology? Is it called the Gordian knot? Is that what it's called?
Yes.
That once you get, what is it? It's, what's it called? What's the base? What's that?
It's called the Gordian knot, but I don't know.
You don't know the myth associated with it. Well, I kind of sort of know it, but I won't mess with it because it's not that significant, really. So that's what we have. We have taken the sword to this knot. It unravels the entire thing. That's what we're talking about, the emancipation of everybody. And those who are short-sighted can't see it. And white people in particular can't see it, short-sightedness, because there's this assumption that the world is supposed to be like this, going to be like this forever. And so people try to hold on to the present. When you hold on to these relationships, it's like holding on to the present. It does not work. The future happens. And the thing is for us to become accomplices of history, as opposed to try to stand in the way of this train that's the future. I probably lumped in a whole bunch of metaphors there and mixed them up, but it doesn't work anyway. So we're talking about revolutionary transformation. And we are materialists. And as materialists, there are several things that we recognize. But the key thing is that matter, practice, is primary. It is more significant to the material world than ideas. Ideas are born from relations in the world, from being on Earth. You can't have an idea without first existing. And it's in our process of existing, the relationships that we engage in, particularly relationship involved in producing and reproducing real life, ideas are born from that. That's where ideas come from. But that's not to understate the significance of ideas. That's not to state the significance of ideas, because Marx was right when he said that theory, when it grips the masses, becomes a material force. So we say that ideas are secondary, but they are important. Because at a certain juncture in history, the ideas are what informs how we move. And if we are locked up in backwards ideas that have no relevance and cannot help us to see the future and move toward the future, then that becomes a fundamental problem for the revolution. That is why Lenin talked about, in terms of what's necessary for revolution, one of the key things necessary for revolution is a revolutionary party that is guided by advanced revolutionary theory to solve the problems that allow us to get to the future. So today, what we are confronted with, obviously, is a situation that is theoretically barren. It's very difficult to see the future. There was a time in the 60s where everybody thought we could see the future. What was happening in Africa? What was happening in Cuba? What was happening in Latin America? What was happening in Vietnam, China? The future appeared to be before us, and it was a mobilizing kind of thing. But today, it's relatively barren, theoretically. What seems to dominate in terms of what's in motion and responsible for much of the motion in the world today, you're looking at, you know, religious fundamentalism, Islam blowing up things and challenging imperialism in a very serious way, but it does not seem to show us the future. It does not offer us anything theoretically. It does not give me some information. I can't see it inspiring some Africans here that the way forward is in this fashion and in a way that's going to help us. So the question of theory is incredibly significant, because there was a time when a lot of people were mobilized by what they saw, especially with the Soviet Union. It looked like the world and the future was actually being concretized and materialized for a lot of people by what they saw in the Soviet Union. And then by what people refer to as Marxism seemed to show the world. Workers and oppressed peoples all around the world, intellectuals all around the world were mobilized. They began to do things. They tried to unite with the process that the Marxists were involved in because of that. Theory was profoundly important. But what are you going to do today? Join your local mosque? Or in the African community, the next Kwanzaa celebration, right? So that's why the issue of theory is really important. And that's why it is important also the existence of the African People Solidarity Committee as an arm, an organization of the African People Socialist Party, participating in a process that recognizes a division of labor and a struggle to put leadership on every front, every possible front. And in my view, one of the most effective and significant fronts that we have. See, the stuff used to be Bass Ackwards, when you had the Marxists explaining somehow that the African communities was auxiliaries of the revolutionary process. It was Bass Ackwards. It was the tail wagging the dog, right? And so what we have come to understand, this whole understanding of what we call primitive accumulation of parasitic capitalism shows us that that's wrong. It's upside down. So we want to affect every front in the world where it's possible to advance and to create the new world that we are fighting for. So APSC is important, and one of the most significant components of this division of labor and the struggle to make this revolution happen. And I'm highly appreciative of Comrade Penny and Comrade Alley and the leadership of APSC, who have taken us through some extraordinarily difficult times in the organization itself, who held fast and helped us through. I want to talk just a bit about, and this is, by the way, what I'm talking about is revolutionary transformation. Because I have done a poor job of conveying to our party, to our movement, the significance of the work that we're involved in now, and of the various fronts where we are working, and how all of that promotes the new world that we are fighting for. But we are on so many fronts now. You know, we kicked off reparations work in the world.
Yes.
As mass work. We did that.
Yeah.
And some of you were there and participated in helping to make that happen. There was no such thing as a mass reparations movement until 1982.
That's right.
When we initiated the first tribunal there. And then, not just initiated, but the way we initiated, because we went all around, particularly New York City. People now who in the reparations movement have become household names, became involved in the reparations movement through process that we set in motion. Roger Wareham, who's going to be in Ethiopia, he was somebody who participated in the reparations work that we initiated in New York City. Reluctantly, I should say, even. And there are other, you know, folk who came to this work in the same way. Dorothy Lewis had been doing reparation work, was made a public personality around reparation work because she was somebody we put as head of the reparations organization that we built in 1982. So, you know, we play fundamental roles, and I would remind you also that the first reparations tribunal didn't just deal with reparations. I mean, it was publicly, that's all it dealt with. But at the same time we did the reparations conference, at the same time we did another conference that was not public. And that was a conference to build the African Socialist International. At the same time in New York City, of course it was made a little complicated because one of the African who came there had to pry him out of a trailer or something. Wasn't a trailer something in his place? And then he had one of the solidarity workers go back to Barbados with him to liberate Barbados or something. It came with some complications. I should take that back. There's all kinds of puns associated with that. Anyway, I just want to talk a little bit about one of the critical questions that we've been grappling with, and we are still working with it, still developing it, because we think that this is the question that will help us to deal with every issue in the future. And that is the question of the nation. And the nation is not something that people talk about ordinarily. It's not a part of just common discussion. You don't hear, you know, your neighbors talking much about what's your position on the nation, the national question, things like that. And the nation is something that, if you ask somebody, what is the nation, or do you know what a nation or the nation is, they'll say yes, most people, but they couldn't explain it. And that's not just, you know, ordinary laypersons that we're talking about. Even people who are considered well-grounded in social and political theory, history, have a real problem of defining what is the nation, a priori. A priori, right? You know, they can say, oh, that's the nation over there, that thing that right there is. But to say, what is the nation? Is the nation something that can be defined prior to you actually seeing this entity here by definition? Can it be defined? And it's been controversial what the nation is historically, since the word entered into our vocabulary, a political vocabulary, the question of the definition of a nation has been controversial. But it does exist. The nation is evidence of Marx's being correct when he says that theory, when it grips the masses, is a material force. The nation does exist. It exists because people believe in it and believe it, and it plays a certain fundamental role. Now, there has always been a tendency in human society, in its development, of moving like from smaller to larger units of human beings. Start family, tribe, clan, you know, larger communities, etc. That's always been the case. But historically, how these entities have been defined, you know, have changed. And it's not like a transient, it's not like a static issue, this question of the nation. But I just want to say that the nation as we understand it today has its origins in real problems that had to be resolved in European society. I want to say that although there's discussion, people talk about the French, the Germans, the Swedish, the Belgium, Dutch nations, French nations, I disagree with that. I think that there is a European nation, and that there are various states around which certain capital is organized, but they'll be looking at the same nation. And I also want to say that the nation that we, the basis of what we now define as the nation, comes from a need to solve a problem in European history at a particular time. It has its origin in Europe, this thing that we call the nation right now. Has its origin in Europe. It was born out of a need in Europe. And what, not a perceived need, as I've heard it said, but a real need in Europe. And I would help to define and describe the process given rise to the nation. And it's really important to understand this because for a long period, up until the era of slavery and colonialism going into what we now refer to as capitalism, people who we now refer to as Europeans define themselves primarily in relationship to each other. Primarily in relationship to each other. Who would we be talking about then?
Gauls.
This primarily, and you should see some of the things said about define how these groups were defining each other. This was the basic thing. Constant warfare, struggle, etc. It was slavery and colonialism that began to do several things. One, it began to create an economy that even as it created certain competition for resources, began to be also a thing that united this whole body. All of them were participating in this single economy, the slave trade. Whether directly or indirectly, all the wealth that began to come into Europe and to define the European economy, born out of slavery and then out of colonialism. All of Europe, therefore, began to have a common trajectory toward slavery and toward colonialism. So that increasingly the definition was not primarily one in relationship to each other, but primarily in relationship to those that all of Europe was involved in enslaving and colonizing. We're talking about, initially, there was this common thing for a long time, probably going back to Rome, this concept of Christendom. Europe was characterized as this place of Christendom. So Christendom, Christianity, it was what informed in part the unity that led to the so-called holy wars, the crusades, right? Christendom. It was a looting expedition done under the religious flag, right? So Christianity was a factor. And then we see out of slavery a world economy emerging that united the entire white world out of slavery and colonialism. Now, it also, this process that created this unity began to change situations in Europe and change situations in the rest of the world. So now you begin to have resources coming to Europe that leads to what we refer to as the Industrial Revolution, all kinds of transformation. And you're binding tighter together, even as it sometimes would fight each other over who was going to get what piece of the action. But all of Europe needed the action. All of Europe needed the action, needed this relationship, this economic relationship that was coming through the exploitation of the rest of us. And all of Europe was able to use Christianity as a basis for doing this. In fact, the Pope gave and legalized slavery, saying you can have that and you can have that, and shared the world between the rest of them, rest of Europe. And so you have this process of emergent collective consciousness born out of this economic relationship, which is a world relationship. So even as it's being born and growing, it's happening at the expense of Africa and other oppressed peoples around the world. All of us, there's a dialectical relationship that is created. And what happens, of course, is that when most of us met Europeans, Europe was bogged down in feudalism, where discipline was imposed on the vast majority of the population through feudal laws, customs, traditions, trapped on the land. Most of the people who worked on land owned by the feudal lords, etc., had no freedom of mobility, etc., and could earn only, and were constantly being exploited, and the exploitation was visible. You know, it's not like hidden exploitation like with capitalism, where people think that, you know, they're getting paid what they work for. In feudalism, you could see that you weren't getting paid what you were working for, because part, you know, the landlord came and took his part off the top, right? So you had this kind of relationship, and it was enforced by armies, military, etc. But now you have a whole world that's being transformed as a consequence of all these resources coming to Europe. You have a new social force being born, new social forces. You've got a new ruling class attempting to emerge. It takes revolution to complete this process. The capitalist ruling class, You've got the land enclosure acts and other things pushing the peasants off the land because you can't have capitalist production if people can feed themselves on the land. They need to be off the land. They need to be off the land so they can work in the factories. But if they can work in the factories and are not tied to the land, what is it that holds them loyal to the ruling class? Huh? What is it that makes them somebody who can be trusted? Why are they to be loyal to the ruling class now? They got freedom of mobility. They need it. In order for capitalism to work, they have to be able to go out and sell their labor power. This means they're not tied to the land anymore. They can go anywhere they want to sell the value of their labor power. That's an absolute necessity for the development of capitalism in the world. So what makes them loyal? Why would they be loyal? They are now loyal because they are a part of the nation. The nation born out of this process, where a ruling class now comes to power and using this newly developed state, loyal to the flag, loyal to the oath of allegiance, loyal to the holidays that supposedly define who we are, loyal to the myths that are created. I've read, and I can't think of this man's name. I always get this wrong. I think he was an Italian, though, who played a major role in the development of what people refer to as the Italian nation. And he said, at a certain juncture, he said, "We have created Italy. Now we must create Italians." Right? And so the concept is to have a people that who becomes loyal to the myth, to the symbols, to the body. This is the thing that you can let them leave. They'll leave the country and they'll die. Their patriotism, which is simply loyal to the bourgeoisie, loyalty to the existing bourgeoisie. They will die sometimes for the same, so the ruling class is ripping them off. You ask the question about why do white people hop on ships and go kill and die? Loyalty. There's nobody there. They don't have the police there watching them saying, "If you don't do this, we're going to shoot you. We're keeping your mother here so that if you don't carry this out, we're going to kill her." Loyalty. There is a particular need at a particular time in history for the emergence of the nation. That's the basic point that I'm making here. And then we have this thing, and it's born out of a historical process of slavery and colonialism consolidating itself as capitalism in the world. Now, so now you have this reality. As I said, you know, depending on the capital that is organized around, sometimes we characterize it as the French nation and the this nation, but we see that it ain't that different. It's the same. That's why all of Europe accepts the Roman Empire as a part of its glorious history. All of Europe accepts the Greek democracy as part of its glorious history. In fact, that's why it's difficult even for white people to be opposed to imperialism. Because to be opposed to imperialism, to be opposed to empire, and Rome is the essence of the identity of Europe. All of Europe, all high culture, so-called high culture that Europeans enjoy, whether it's singing in French or Italian or what have you, is considered part of European culture. You know, it's the same thing. And increasingly, the economic reality is breaking down what appears to be some of these other borders that mess that issue up. And the fact is that this ain't the first time, like you see the European Union trying to emerge and what have you, where the Vienna Congress in the 19th century was another time when people sat down at the table and reorganized Europe and who was what and what have you. So it's not a new thing, and of course in recent history, where there used to be a Czechoslovakia, you know, and there used to be a Yugoslavia, but that doesn't exist anymore. And it doesn't exist anymore because there's a certain kind of, there's a turmoil that's shaking up all of these economic factors in the world that's challenging the notion of who the hell anybody is. But the fact is that there is a European nation, and the European nation is defined by economic relationships, material relationships, an economy. It all exists off of this process of slavery and colonialism and a world economy that continues to maintain it and holds it all together economically. It is characterized by Christianity and by whiteness. And it ain't good enough to be one. You're a Christian, you gotta be white too. And it ain't good enough to be white, you gotta be Christian. And which is one of the reasons that it was possible for the Holocaust to happen. One of the reasons, because to be a part of the nation is not something that one simply say, okay, I'm a part of the nation. You can say that in your brain if you want to. That's a subjective factor. But to be a part of the nation is to be accepted by the greater body also. And that's why Turkey is having so much problems now, trying to become a part of the European Union. Every time Turkey does everything, lays on his belly, yeah, does backflips and whatever, but it's a Muslim country. You ain't welcome. Doesn't mean that it's not significant to be white for this nation, because it is. Because you are better off as a white Jew than you are as a black Christian. You see? But they all go together to be accepted as a part of the nation. And that's a part of it anyway that we're messing with. The other thing I just want to share with you briefly, because this could go on forever. And again, we're still grappling with some of this because, you know, you can do a lot of study and research on what I'm talking about. But it's right, it's true. But I wanted to share the one that Europe founded itself, that the European nation was founded off of the assault on the rest of the world, because after all, the Indians was killing themselves. Mm-hmm. In many ways, Europe rescued them by showing up. Yeah. You understand? You see stuff what's the Roman stuff? Rome. There's a TV thing on Rome now. There's a thing that what's the movie that this guy Mel Gibson, who played in as some kind of Scottish hero, all of this stuff, right, raising up, it's the whole thing, and it's a self-defense, it's ideological self-defense, all this stuff that we're seeing. What's the thing with the other guy? It's the guy who follows this woman around to Namibia. He started, wearing a lot of clothes. Yeah, what's the name of it?
Babel or Babel?
No, not Babel. Anyway, I can't think of the name, but it was, from a Greek myth where they fled this war of Troy. You know, all of this is resurrecting, yeah, this is self-defense, it's ideological self-defense, yeah, in the face of the whole world now struggling to define themselves and define the world as ideological self-defense. That not only unites white people, but all the people around the world who see that stuff. You understand? Superman is nationalism. I mean, that's real obvious, you know, fighting for the American way and what have you, you understand? But it's really important because to have the state, that's one of the reasons the state is such an important instrument in the whole question of nations. Nationalists exist before nations. Nationalists create nations. Nations don't create nationalists. But this is a part of you know, the identity, you know, even Spider-White Man. It's over and over reinforcement of a heroic character that's in there somehow, you know, waiting to be let out. So, the African Revolution, the thing about what you will notice is that, for example, in Africa, 35 of the 48 so-called independent states that white power left there have less than 10 million people in there. And part of this is to prevent the consolidation of a group that's able to contend. That's why Iraq could be fractured. That's why fracture every damn thing so that there, that's why Somalia was fractured intentionally.
Yeah.
So that there could not be a bloc large enough to, that's why the African community in St. Petersburg after the rebellion, that's why Africans are being pushed out of everywhere so you can't have blocs enough
who can consolidate to fight back.
Right.
That's why theory, ideology is so important. That's why when we talk about the Africans organizing, we have to be talking about a struggle for national liberation, the freedom of African people as a nation, and be able to explain that. Now, Garvey was the only one who moved in this fashion. He didn't talk about the nation and the theory, but everything he did was based on the assumption of an all-African nation that involved African people everywhere, including Australia. Africans from Australia, black people from Australia were part of the Garvey movement. And so it becomes the responsibility of the African Revolution to define and organize the African nation. And we are in the process of doing that, and some things that we know is that the African nation is characterized by black people wherever they exist on earth, by people in Africa, by black people in Africa, and others who have accepted and practiced the historical mission of Africa to liberate and unite itself. And what I'm saying is that does not include the sudden epiphanous southern South Africans, right, who suddenly become Africans once it looks like things are going the other way, sort of, as it benefits them, because that does not challenge the existing order, does it? That Africa's historical mission cannot be realized with the South Africa. It means that there are people who, the majority of the so-called Arabs, they live in Africa. Did you know that? Majority of Arabs are in Africa. But the ability of them to stay there, and the final analysis is going to be determined by their ability to accept as their own the historical mission for the liberation and unification of Africa under black power. Now, and that's a good thing to fight for. And at one time in history, there were Arabs who were able to do that.
Yeah.
Nasser, who worked with a petty bourgeois African. Ben Bella, at a certain juncture, because the African Revolution was on the rise. And at that juncture, people wanted to be a part of it. And they tried to be a part of the African Revolution. They weren't talking about we are part of the Arab Revolution. They weren't saying we are the Islamic Revolution. They were part of the African Revolution, even though they were Muslims. I there's an anecdote, that's important for me, because I remember I used to know this African who was born in Puerto Rico, but when I met this African during the Black Power movement, his name was Lumumba. After the defeat of the Black Revolution, I met him again. He was a young lord. His name was Che. Right? And so the consciousness. And you have in Africa today, there are Africans and North African people who look just like me, phenotypically, like me, on the one hand, but call themselves Arabs. And then in St. Petersburg, there are people who look like me who call themselves Americans, right? But there are Africans, and part of the task of the African Revolution is to organize the African nation, make it conscious of its existence, conscious of its task, historical mission, and to lead it to revolutionary conclusions. And as this, and this is our task, this is the task of the party led by the African working class, because we are not the only social forces in the African world who, through actions of some sort or another, are attempting to define what the African nation looks like. There are some people who are saying that I just had an email from somebody who was defining the African nation. Email while I was on the radio show as this new block of folk in East Africa, because I'm East African grouping. They talk about this is a nation. That ain't no nation. And there are some people who live right now in Ghana, Africans who went back to Africa, went to Ghana, been there 15, left New York 15, 16 years ago, who call themselves part of the African-American tribe, et cetera. And there are some people who have
something that approximates power are fighting for it, who would put in Africa, who see African people as a part of a huge market that they need to control, right? But does not, who have no intent of challenging their relationship fundamentally in a way that will raise up the masses of people as custodians of our own resources and our future. So the African working class must prevail. It must prevail. African internationalism must prevail. A scientific assessment must prevail. History is made by human beings. So no matter what the damn ideas that are out there, if human beings aren't in motion to bring them to fruition, it's meaningless. It's as worthless as used toilet paper. So the African internationalism must prevail. We must win. And we are now in this really ideologically barren place. That's why it's so important that we grow and that we build now. That we take these ideas out into the world, right? And the thing that makes us significant is that we're not just taking ideas out into the world, we're taking processes, projects, campaigns out in the world that actually represent the concretization of these ideas, whether some of the people who are involved in us recognize it or not. When we talk about ITRAP and the World Tribunal, it's based on the assumption of an all African process, presence, future, and past. When we talk about the ASI, that's part of it. All the work that we do represents that recognition. When we talk about the development project and program, it's not just an idea. We began to concretize it so that when we talk to people about these ideas, people who don't see the future easily, they can see it manifest there. For example, I can't buy women's clothing easily. I have to see it on something. Somebody or a mannequin or something to you know, be able to buy it, to say that, like that's all right. Just women's clothing hang up, I can't do it. And so what we have to do is create this mannequin, right, so that people who might not be able to see the future, we give them something that they can see it with. That's why these projects are so important. And we got a lot of work to do. That's why the radio is so important. We got a lot of work to do because all of these projects, all of these institutions that we create are sort of like a skeleton around that we put in, you know, this flesh, you know, of the future on. That was a spin infinitive, but I can live with it. So we're still grappling and developing some of these ideas, but hopefully we will find this discussion helpful. Only other thing I would add to that is this, that there is a concept that we talk about all the time when we talk to the African revolutionaries. Because we say that the African working class must lead this process. Because the African working class has no stakes, no interests, no material interests in things as they are. It has no material interest in the existence of the borders. It has no material interest in being Jamaican or Haitian, all of this. Only forces who have material interest are the African petty bourgeoisie, who somehow reaps resources, except they have a material interest. They sometimes confuse the rest of us. They win us in our brains, but there's no material interest there, which means what? That we are materialists. We recognize that if somebody else has won their brains right now, we can win their brains. We can fight for their brains. And there are elements who are the African petty bourgeoisie, and the petty bourgeoisie is a traitorous social force. It will always betray the revolution as a social force. But there are elements within the petty bourgeoisie who have the ability to do what we call commit class suicide. They can abandon the interests of the petty bourgeoisie, which anyway is the past, because the petty bourgeoisie is a dying social force. And they can unite with the future by uniting with the interests of the African working class. Sometimes they can recognize the interests of the African working class before the class can recognize it, because they have access to so much more information. They are the educated sectors of the community, right? And so just as they can commit class suicide, we say that is also possible in this historical process that we're talking about for North Americans to abandon the interests of the European nation, to commit national suicide, and essentially that's what the highest level of APSC has done and is attempting to bring the rest of the North Americans and Europeans into Uhuru.
Uhuru, Shannon, that was profound.